It is well known that environments have an impact on IQ, but a new article shows just how radical of an impact the prison environment has on cognition. We'll be discussing this article and its important implications in today's episode. Welcome back to the IQ and Human Intelligence Podcast. This is where we explore the nature of intelligence, the importance of cognitive abilities, and how science helps us understand human potential. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Woodley of Mani, an independent scholar who specializes in evolutionary analysis. He's with me to talk about his new article called The Reversal of Spearman's Hypothesis in Incarcerated Populations and the Role of Non-Shared Environmentality. This article was published in the journal Intelligence and Cognitive Abilities. I'm glad you've joined us for this interesting discussion. So let's begin. Dr. Woodley, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Russell.
Well, tell me a little bit about your background and how you got interested in intelligence research.
Well, my undergraduate work was in the, my degree was on the topic of evolutionary ecology, broadly construed. My PhD work was on the molecular ecology of a plant and its associated rhizosphere flora called Arabidopsis thaliana. So I've always had an interest in evolutionary genetics and evolutionary ecology. So I sort of moved my focus toward studying humans within the period 2008 to 2009, largely because it was a fairly underutilized niche, essentially, relatively few people with evolutionary genetic backgrounds going into fields like behavior genetics and evolutionary psychology. So I saw an opportunity there to sort of build an academic career around humans and also primates as well. I have a significant amount of interest in comparative psychology, birds and primates in particular.
And you can definitely see that through line of evolutionary thinking and theorizing in your work. And we're here to talk about an article about prison populations, but you know, we might have you back to talk about some of your work with birds and non-human primates and stuff, because all of it's very interesting. The article title mentions the phrase Spearman's hypothesis. Could you please tell our audience what Spearman's hypothesis is and why it's important?
So basically, different measures of cognitive ability measure the underlying construct of general intelligence to different extents, and you can rank measures of intelligence based on the degree to which they are valid measures of the G factor, this being the general cognitive ability which undergirds most measures of cognitive ability. So it was noted by Charles Spearman back in the 1920s that individuals who had been assigned to the social racial categories of black and white within the British context, the difference in the ability means tended to be larger on those measures that were better measures of this underlying G factor or general cognitive ability. But he coined the term Spearman's hypothesis to describe what he thought was a sort of law-like regularity in psychometrics, that is to say, the positive correlation between the test's G level, or G saturation rather, and the magnitude of the performance disparity between these means of these social racial groups.
And I find it to be important because from a measurement perspective, because I'm a measurement person, I created an IQ test myself. It's important to realize that why some of these tests are better measures of intelligence than others, it has important implications about how we interpret scores. And Spearman's hypothesis gives us this nice framework for understanding that. So with that in mind, can you describe the study you conducted and the findings?
Well, the conventional tests of Spearman's hypothesis fall into two categories. The ideal way of showing that the group difference relates to a difference in the means of G is to use latent variable modeling. So what's called confirmatory factor analysis, where you compare multiple groups to one another and you can test for a property called measurement invariance. But not all data are really suitable for the purpose of those kinds of confirmatory factor analytic models. So a sort of quick and dirty method, which was developed by Arthur Jensen and has been used in I think around 200 or 300 publications now, is this idea of the method of correlated vectors. So you can rank these tests based on the magnitude of their G-loading, and you can take another variable that's associated with performance on those subtests. So in the case of Spearman's hypothesis, you can look at the difference in the means between different social groups. So this could be people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. It could be people with who've been assigned to different social racial categories, or different ancestry groups, or different religious groups, or whatever. As long as you have a group,
I've seen a Spearman's hypothesis study where it was on adoptees.
You correlate the size of a group difference on each subtest with the size of its corresponding G loading, and you'll get a correlation that's either positive, neutral, or negative in magnitude. Mm-hmm. And it turns out in most cases, and I actually have a meta-analysis that's pretty comprehensive that I've yet to finalize. But generally speaking, with the so-called black-white difference, that is to say the difference in the means of performance between individuals who are socially identified as black and socially identified as white, these are social categories. The difference in means correlates with the size of a G-loading at around 0.5 to 0.6. It's the second method, the method of correlated vectors, that we use in this paper to test mm-hmm. for a role of G-loading in moderating this particular group difference. But unlike other studies of Spearman's hypothesis, which use normalization samples or samples of individuals sourced from normal social contexts, we used those very, very rare studies of individuals who are tested in situ as people who are in what are known as carceral or incarcerated populations. So these are people who are in situ within the prison system. So they could be juvenile delinquents or they could be adult prisoners, but they had to be in situ. They had to actually be in the prison context, basically, rather than outside of it. And the hypothesis that I was testing was that the environments found within prisons have two unusual qualities. So one is they activate racial identity very strongly, much more strongly than is found in the normal environment outside of prisons. The environments associated with prisons are associated with very highly unpredictable sorts of environmental hardship. So prisons are really not very nice places to be, and you really don't want to be in prison because the environments within prisons are very nasty. You hear all these horrible stories about people being stabbed and, you know, worse things happening to them. These are all, you know, these are all sort of reflective of the underlying quality or lack of quality of that environment. So my theory was that under normal circumstances, the group difference between socially identified black and white individuals can be a function of, as Kahn has pointed out, culture loading. The environment is very different. As the environment is sort of random and harsh, meaning that there's high variance in and high absolute levels of mortality and morbidity, especially morbidity, this sort of environment will actually produce a different pattern to these group differences. It should, in fact, reverse Spearman's hypothesis. Was we took two measures of black-white performance differences from two very suitable studies, used an old version of the Wechsler test called the Wechsler-Bellevue test, identified two vectors, that is to say, subtest level measures of non-shared environmentality from behavior genetic studies using Wechsler. We looked at culture loading as well, which is Kahn's variable that he believes generates the group difference under normal circumstances. And we also looked at normalization samples. So we were able to take three age-specific vectors from the same normalization sample, and we threw all of these vectors. There are only sort of 10 subtests in length, so we're not talking about thousands of participants. We're talking about degrees of freedom of 10.
Yeah.
And we tested to see if the data was suitable for factor analysis. It was. And we found two factors emerging. So one was a sort of cluster which included the G loadings and the culture loadings, but they loaded negatively onto the factor. And the two prison population black-white difference vectors loaded positively, so in opposition to the G loading, in opposition to the culture loading, and positively with the two non-shared environmentality measures. And there was a separate uncorrelated factor which contained the three normalization group differences vectors, which wanted to hang together very strongly. So we sort of got an anti-Spearman and a Spearman factor out of this, which was consistent with the hypotheses that I just outlined.
Yeah, and that's why it caught my attention, because normally when we compare these two social groups, American black, American white, we do get this beautiful 0.5, 0.6 correlation that the better the test measures general intelligence, the wider the group averages are apart, and then the worse the test measures intelligence, the more similar the two group averages are. And that completely breaks down in your study. And not only does it break down, that non-family sort of random environment piece ends up being the stronger predictor. And that's very surprising. We don't see this outside of incarcerated populations. That's why I wanted to talk to you about the article. You mentioned the prison environment being, to put it mildly, unpleasant. It's very harsh. It's very random. Why, from the perspective of an evolutionary theorist, would a harsh, negative, random environment be so important?
Because humans have experienced periods of environmental unpredictability, which has a very, or rather environmental harshness and unpredictability. So these things have very specific mathematical meanings within life history theories. When we talk about an environment being unpredictable, we're talking about the variance in morbidity and mortality being high. We're talking about an environment being harsh. We're talking about an environment in which the total level of mortality is very high. So from a life history theoretic perspective, such environments tend to favor the canalization of faster life history traits, which according to Bruce Ellis et al., include a suite of situationally dependent cognitive skills, which are upregulated as harshness adaptations, but on a situational basis. You will only see them within that context.
So if I can clarify, when we talk about harshness, we're not talking about the fact that in prison there's not a lot of privacy, you sleep on a hard bunk. We're talking about harshness as far as survivability, randomness as far as survivability, not, oh, prison's not a fun place to be.
Well, it's interesting because the two are related. So
true.
Humans have evolved psychological dispositions towards interpreting environmental cues as precursors to the quality of environments going forwards. So the first sign you have of an adverse environment might not necessarily be people dropping dead randomly, like during a plague or something. Well, that's a very high salience mortality cue, right? There are other qualitative factors of the environment, which could reflect in things like individual privacy, individual comfort, people being forced to keep close company, environments that are sort of structured in ways that create adverse gene environment interactions, that sort of thing. Those things can all function as precursors. They can act as sort of evolutionary psychological primes for environmental harshness. We're evolved to treat those indicators as co-equally valid, because if we don't treat them as co-equally valid and we make mistakes and we allocate effort into, you know, certain kinds of bioenergetic resource acquisition or the development of an aspect of a phenotype, and it turns out that allocations are misallocation because the environment has changed in an unpredictable way, and the fitness costs to that are significant. So it makes sense that humans are going to have available to them a suite of adaptations which will be situationally executed, that is to say, expressed when certain epigenetic cues are present in the environment. And I suspect that those epigenetic cues are present in the environment to a greater extent than in the prison environment, than a greater extent to in day-to-day life outside of a prison context.
If you're enjoying this conversation, please take a moment to like this video and subscribe to our channel. It really helps us reach more people who are interested in the science of IQ and human intelligence. Additionally, our team has developed the first professional, purely online IQ test called the Riot IQ test. You can try our IQ test through the link in the description, or visit Riot IQ to take the test and learn more about your own intelligence and cognitive profile. Now, back to the episode.
So we have your outside of prison environment, which is very stable for most people. It's safe. There's a high degree of privacy. We don't have as many of these danger environmental cues. Someone goes into prison, major environmental change, and without the person realizing it, of course, there is a trigger to support certain cognitive ways of functioning and not others in order to survive this scary, random, dangerous environment. Am I understanding you correctly?
Precisely. So they are strategically upregulating or expressing adaptations which ordinarily you wouldn't have to avail yourself of. So I think Vlad Griskovicius, who's a researcher at the University of New Mexico, has written about how different forms of executive functioning are differentially expressed among individuals living in stable, predictable versus unstable, harsh environments. So in the case of executive function, which involves updating, that tends to be promoted to a greater extent in an environment wherein you have high predictability. And this makes sense because only in instances where you can anticipate a change does it make sense to be able to update. Switching, however, which is a much more contingent thing and is more open-ended developmentally, is sort of hypertrophied or, you know, overdeveloped among individuals living in a faster life history. environmental context. And related to this is work I did.
No, it's very interesting, though. Do you think there are other environments in the world today that may lead to this breakdown of Spearman's hypothesis and this canalization of mental abilities and skills that are more neglected in stable environments?
Well, I think that the environment which comes closest to this in terms of those environments that I've studied in relation to these sort of vector correlation type models is lead exposure. So toxins in general, so this would include dioxins, methyl mercury, and also lead. And I published a meta-analysis on this in Personality and Individual Differences in 2018, I think it was. Yes, 2018. I've published so many of these things, I lose track.
That's a good problem this to have.
Yes. This one basically looked at the degree to which lead exposure reduces the level of cognitive ability among groups that had been exposed. So we were not using a social racial basis for grouping. We were looking at people who were actually exposed to high levels of lead toxicity and versus people who were control groups that were not. And what we found in that meta-analysis, which was quite large actually, was that the effect is a sort of neutral, it's a null zero magnitude effect. A lot of the effects are in fact negative, so it's a sort of dissymmetric distribution. But there were a lot of effects which were negative. The overall effect was basically almost exactly zero. So I suspect that you could probably, if you looked at the social racial differences in the context of environments that were characterized by very high levels of toxins, the presence of neurotoxins in particular, which are a source of stress and a resource of high morbidity and mortality as well, because people develop diseases more frequently when they're around toxic substances, which is why they're a problem, of course. You know, something has to be done about them. But I suspect that if you were to, again, look at this group difference in the context of those specific environments, my prediction is you'd find the same reversal for the same reason. But I have yet to identify samples which are sort of in from that context. Essentially, it's very, very rare, and obviously, it's not something anyone can. It's not like you can just sort of pull those samples out of a hat. Yeah. They're very, very hard to find. They're very rare,
especially in countries like the U.S. and the U.K., where we've cleaned up our environments. We don't have as we did in the 70s, large populations of people with extremely high lead exposure. I was thinking of other environments, war-torn countries, places where terrorist attacks are very common. That's very hard to do research in those places. So I'm not surprised that there's not a lot of research and that prisons might be the most accessible place to research this.
Yes.
You see any implications for people who administer intelligence tests in a forensic setting?
I still think that people working on, cognitive assessment within the criminal justice system, particularly within a carceral context, ought to be very mindful of the possibility that those tests are not yielding measurement invariant results with respect to those found in normative samples. And I think greater awareness of the possibility that there might be hidden talents, to use the Bruce Ellis term, that those might be at play, is something that should be investigated, I think, to a greater extent, for no other reason than we need to understand what these things are from a psychometric point of view.
Mm-hmm. And it does introduce some interesting psychometric questions of, well, if Spearman's hypothesis and the way that the subtests function and load, if that breaks down in the prison, even though it's the same test, can we not interpret it the same way in a prisoner population, which has some important legal ramifications, at least within the U.S.? So I'm glad you brought up the study, because it has, I love the theory. I love how it ties in evolutionary theory. I love how it's a surprising breakdown for what we normally see. And then I love the practical implications from it too. And that's why it caught my eye. Now, what new questions do you see arise from this study? What new research questions should scientists be pursuing in light of these findings?
It would be interesting to see if the result actually replicates, indeed, if it can be found in modern populations of prisoners, or have carceral environments improved in such a way that has reduced the factors that are likely to elicit these processes that cause the positive manifold to sort of decompose, at least as a source of these group differences. And yes, more broadly, I think I like your idea of, obviously I don't like the idea of war-torn countries, but I like the idea of war-torn countries being a potential source of testing this environmentally mediated model. I think there are opportunities to collect data from some of these areas. I know people who work on life history in countries where you have very low political stability and low trust and high crime and things, and they seem to be able to get the data in sometimes quite extraordinary circumstances. So I know people who do work on these questions. But I mean, a final thing on that particular question is, I think we just have to be very, very careful when making causal statements about the etiology of these group differences, not simply because this matter is very socially sensitive, but also because there are many defects in the existing literature which I am actively interested in correcting. Mm-hmm. And there are many unanswered questions and open goals, essentially, for those who are looking at the role of environmental effects in the generation of these and other group differences. And in my own work, I have found that these questions yield intriguing answers when addressed properly. And what never ceases to surprise me is how little interest there is in addressing these questions from anyone. Mm-hmm. You'd imagine that there'd be people chomping at the bit, as they say, to address these issues of environmental causes of inequalities, yet there doesn't really seem to be interest in these things. It's more playing political games than anything else, and I think that's very sad. So I would just like it if people took these things more seriously and actually did what I'm trying to do, which is to investigate these things properly.
And that's another reason why I liked it, because there is so much nuance. The message from the article is, hey, conditioned upon the environment having XYZ circumstances, we can get this result when we compare social groups. But in a totally different environment, those results break down completely. And that's just as fascinating. And I think it tells us, number one, how important environment is for individuals. But number two, how important environment has been in our evolutionary history. And of course, Darwin's hearing this in his grave saying, well, of course, it's what I told you the whole time. But I really think it brings home the individual and the species level scale of the importance of the environment. And on a time scale, going from a stable, predictable environment in the outside world to an unstable, unpredictable, dangerous environment in prison, well, that's a small time scale in one person's life. But then also this forces us evolutionarily to look at the long time scale, because a lot of our evolutionary ancestors did live in these unpredictable, dangerous environments that had important implications on their mental abilities back then and on ours today, because their environment selected for certain abilities and not others.
Yes, and I think that the fullness of what we are in terms of the factors that co-contribute not just to individual differences but to intra-individual differences also is something that's very, very poorly understood.
Thanks for watching the IQ and Human Intelligence podcast. If you want to read Dr. Woodley of Manee's article for yourself in the journal Intelligence and Cognitive Abilities, visit the link in the description to the video. The article is free and open to everyone with no paywall. It is called The Reversal of Spearman's Hypothesis in Incarcerated Populations and the Role of Non-Shared Environmentality. You can find a link to the article in this video description. If you liked this episode, don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow us on social media. The links are in the description. And if you're curious about your own IQ, you can take our professional online IQ test at riotiq.com. It's the world's first professional, publicly accessible online IQ test and a great way to learn more about your own cognitive strengths. And if you found this episode interesting, you'll really enjoy our episode with Craig Frisby, in which we discuss test bias on intelligence tests. Watch that episode if you haven't yet. See you next time. Thank you.